circumstances where he can just put it in his pocket.
Then it's approved.
If he wants pocket to veto?
It's the adjourned. Yeah, yeah, but if yeah, they haven't, it's right, approved.
I am the only judge that can use that metaphor. We are a small court, but whatever follows.
Nope, no problem. It was lost on the document.
Joan Oppenheimer for the commissioner.
Welcome back.
Thank you very much. I'll start off with the practical consequences of a decision which this court has requested us to address. There are basically four practical consequences of whether the penalty applicability of penalties is decided at the partnership versus the partner level. The first consequence is if the applicability of the penalties is determined at the partner level, we go back to pre-1997 law with a multiplicity of proceedings where every partner is issued a notice of deficiency, and then each partner has to bring an individual action to determine
the amount.
Well,
the sham will still be done at the I want you to get through your four, but the sham would still be done at the partnership level and wouldn't have to be fought out at each partner level proceeding.
That's correct. The sham would be determined at the partnership level, but the penalty would be determined in individual partner level proceedings.
By that you mean the amount of the penalty?
Well, also the existence of the penalty, because just because a partner is determined to be sham doesn't mean that there would be a penalty in any particular case. The existence of a penalty depends on the existence of a tax underpayment.
Isn't that all the reason to do it in a partner level proceeding?
No, Your Honor.
Okay.
Because
you're saying there are individual circumstances that could affect the amount of the penalty.
Right.
There's going to have to be a partner level proceeding. Period.
No, I'm not saying that. I'm saying there's a difference between a partner level proceeding and a partner level computation. Every penalty requires an individual partner level computation. But if we go back to pre-1997 law, you're saying that there's an individual partner level proceeding to determine even if the penalties are applicable.
Okay, why don't you go to you had 4 points.
Right, so the second point is that if we go back to pre-1997 law, you create the possibility of inconsistent treatment among the different partners. But since they were all in the same partnership, they should be treated the same, and that's what Congress determined when it amended 6221 and 6226. My third point is that the factors that are taken into account in determining the applicability of the penalties vary depending on which proceeding it is considered in. For example, if the applicability of the penalties are determined in a partnership proceeding, then in the case of the negligence penalty, you would consider the partner's negligence, disregard of rules and disregard of rules and regulations. In the case of an overvaluation penalty, you would consider the formation of the partnership to create an overvalued asset or an overvaluation statement on the partnership return, and you would also consider whether the partnership had a reasonable cause defense to the imposition of the penalties. If, however, the applicability of the penalties is only determined in a partner-level proceeding, these factors would be less relevant, and what you would be considering instead was the individual's partner negligence and disregard in the case of the negligence penalty, or an overvaluation on the partner's return rather than the use of a partnership vehicle to create an overvaluation.
Would that mean that the penalty would be modified based on the conditions at the partner level?
No, the outcome might be different. In other words, yes, the determination of whether the penalty was applicable might be different because the factors would be different.
Well, isn't that part of the problem? Counsel, let me ask you this question. Can you tell me what the practical significance is for the Internal Revenue Service? Why is this fight going on? What's underlying this?
I think the commissioner is interested in defending what it views as the clear language of the statute.
The commissioner is never interested in defending the clear language of the statute. The commissioner is always interested in a policy objective, which may or may not be implemented through the statute. What is the basic policy concern here?
Well, nobody has actually told me that, but I can give you two possible answers. Are two things that I think motivate this, although nobody has really told me this. One is the numerous proceedings that would result if the appellee's position is upheld. And the second thing is
numerous proceedings? You mean the separate proceedings at the partner level?
Right.
But they're invariably going to have separate proceedings at the partner level, right?
No, there's only going to be separate proceedings at the partner level if you raise a reasonable cause defense. In other words, if you...
But you were telling me earlier there's certain computations that would have to take place at the partner level.
That's not a proceeding. What happens when penalties are determined at the partnership level is that after that, the commissioner makes a computation of the individual's tax liability and sends notice of computational adjustment. That is not a proceeding.
Is the consequence of if the matter is determined at the partnership level?
Right.
Isn't it the case that the commissioner notifies each partner of his deficiency? And the partner has to pay the tax and sue for a refund in order to contest it?
That's correct. And
whereas if the matter is at the partner level, the partner can come, the commissioner is going to have to go to enforce the claim against the taxpayer.
Well,
isn't that also the case?
Not exactly like that. I think, but your first part is correct. I think if it's determined at the partnership level, the payment will be made sooner because
if the difference is between paying and suing for a refund versus standing back and being sued by the commissioner.
If it is determined at the partner level, the commissioner issues a notice of deficiency, and it is the taxpayer, not the commissioner, who brings the suit.
So we got haven't paid.
Yes, and they haven't paid. So payment, applicability of penalties is determined in the partner level, payment is going to be much later than
exactly.
If.
Exactly. That's what's at stake here, isn't it?
That's one of the things that's at stake. And
it makes a huge difference. If I have to pay in order to sue.
Right.
Many of us are not in a position to pay the $4 or $5 million that we defrauded you of. Right. We've spent it.
I should also add one caveat to this. The commissioner has recently made a determination, assuming now that this court decides that the applicability of penalties is determined in a partnership level proceeding. We stated in our brief that the only thing the taxpayer can do is, if he disagrees with the computation or whatever, is to file is to file a refund claim and sue for a refund. The commissioner...
Meaning pay first and then refund.
Right. The commissioner is now modifying that that position. The commissioner has recently taken the position that the taxpayer could bring a collection due process proceeding under Section 6230 or 6330 to challenge the existence and amount of the underlying tax pay without paying first.
Right. Why go through all that? That just seems to be getting to the same bottom line that the tax court has gotten to in this case, which is you don't have to pay first.
Well, in a CDP proceeding, of course, you wouldn't pay first.
That's my point, which is I thought, as Judge Ginsburg said, the point here is the IRS really wanted it determined in a partnership-level proceeding, which would in turn require an assessment, which would in turn require you to pay first to challenge it. That's what I thought you wanted to force. But now you're telling me, no, the commissioner doesn't even want to force that, and that really undermines the practical reason why you're concerned about the tax court decision in the first place.
Due process collection proceeding is not exactly a level playing field.
Well,
right.
I think...
What do you have to show? What does the taxpayer have to show in a due process proceeding?
Well, if he has not received a notice of deficiency or has had an opportunity to challenge the underlying tax liability, then he is enabled to do so in a CDP proceeding.
Did you say enabled or unable?
Is able to.
And why would he not have been able to have done so before?
Well, he can't do so in a partnership level proceeding. A partnership proceeding only involves things that are unique to the partnership.
So in all cases that we're thinking might have required the taxpayer to pay first, in fact, you're saying the taxpayer can avoid doing that by bringing a due process proceeding.
That is the commissioner's position, and he's currently revising the Internal Revenue Manual to state that he can, can do that.
That's true. I don't understand what the practical significance is of your position. I'm mystified. That's why I was puzzled. That's why I asked the question in the beginning.
Well, I think that brings us back to the multiplicity of proceedings. Your question assumes that in every case a partner is going to, challenge the penalty, which may or may not be the case, but it is much simpler to have it all determined in a partnership level proceeding.
All determined.
The applicability.
The other side points out that you end up with just an abstract concept. You don't have a calculation.
Right, but the applicability of the penalty is determined in one proceeding. If it is not determined in one proceeding, the commissioner must send out a notice of deficiency to every single partner. This is a lot of paper. And that, so you're having potentially numerous proceedings with potentially numerous inconsistent results if the taxpayers reside in different forums and are, therefore bring their suits in different courts.
It's just the paper, though? That's it?
Well, it's not just the paper.
It's the paper and the different proceedings.
It's the paper, the legislative history of this statute.
Hold on one second. The practical consequences, one thing you've identified is that there'd have to be multiple proceedings.
Correct.
Okay. Is there, on these son of boss cases, a potential problem in getting the money you think the IRS is owed because of a statute of limitations problem with the individual partner proceedings, or is there no such thing?
There is a potential statute of limitations problem. In other words, suppose this court holds that you have to determine the applicability of a penalty in the individual partner level proceeding.
In other words, if we affirm the tax court, okay, go ahead.
Suppose then the taxpayer does not reside in the D.C. Circuit. So he brings a notice of deficiency is sent. He brings his suit in the jurisdiction where he resides, which isn't this circuit, and that court holds that the applicability of the penalty has to be determined in a partnership proceeding. In that case, the statute of limitations is blown because we only have 1 year after the conclusion of the partnership proceedings to assess.
So your real problem is the multiplicity of form that you can be faced with. That's your concern.
That's correct.
Uh-huh.
But if a court did that, the Supreme Court would almost certainly take the case and sort out which was correct or which was...
Well, the Supreme Court does what it does.
We talked about last time. There are billions of dollars at issue here, correct?
In the Sonnenbaum cases altogether, you know, if you add the 200 in litigation altogether, that's correct. But in any, you know, if you have a conflict of two different decisions, the Supreme Court may or may not grant cert in any particular case. We can't say it will or it won't.
Now, what about the question of whether we're bound by our prior opinion?
Well, it's our opinion that you're not.
You said it was dicta in our prior opinion.
This court focused on outside basis in your prior opinion, and you did not, you really didn't address the question of whether the applicability of the penalties relate to the shamming of the partnership or the Vanderbeek's contributions to the partnership. The whole focus of the opinion was on outside basis.
But you did say it was dicta, so that you said there was dicta.
That's correct.
And that the dicta suggested that we had a view on this matter. Your argument is it's not binding on a court, but there was clearly a view expressed, wasn't there?
Well, there was a view expressed, but as I said...
What was the view?
Well, the court expressed the view that that this court did not have jurisdiction over penalties that related to outside basis, and it remanded the case to the tax court to determine whether the penalties could be applicable on any other basis, than outside basis. But in this court's opinion, it never said. We concede that. Ultimately, the disallowance of a partnership item has the effect of reducing taxpayers' outside basis, and that in turn has the effect of reducing their basis in the stock that they sold. But this court never said that the applicability of penalties to be determined at a partnership level has to flow directly from the partnership item without, you know, any intermediary steps, and the statute is not worded that way. I think when this court previously considered this issue, the law relating to partner-level computations and partner-level proceedings was not as fully developed as it is in this case.
When we rendered our previous decision?
Yep.
Last year, wasn't it?
That's correct. But
the phrase applicability of a penalty is key in the dispute you have here, and I want to make sure I understand what it means in your view. Does it mean that the taxpayer, the individual partners, will either be penalized by an amount yet to be determined, or perhaps not penalized because they raise a successful defense, but that presumptively there will be a penalty. It's a question of how much or whether they can avoid it.
Well,
is that what applicability means, or does
it means
more than that?
It means potentially applicable. It means.
Does it mean potentially there'll be a liability, potential liability, or potentially applicable?
It means
the tax code is applicable to me, but whether I have any tax liability depends upon things beyond the tax code.
Well, I think
whether I worked, had income.
I think that's a fair statement, that the penalty applies, but whether any taxpayer is liable for the penalty has to do with the facts and circumstances to that particular to that taxpayer.
So all you're saying is it's applicable at the partnership proceeding should include the declaration that a penalty is applicable, amounts later to be determined, defenses later to be considered.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. Robbins?
Thank you, Your Honor. Well, I'm somewhat at a loss as to where to start. That 19-minute exchange presented a cornucopia of issues to respond to, but let me start at the beginning with the question the court asked, the practical application.
Target-rich environment, is that what? Well, maybe you can start with where we finished, the applicability issue, what it means.
Well, let me explain to the court how it plays out in the real world in a normal partnership penalty determination. If there is a TEFRA partner-level proceeding, and it is determined in that proceeding that an accuracy-related penalty, a 20% accuracy-related penalty, is applicable to the partnership because they were negligent when they claimed this particular loss. The commissioner then can take that under the existing statutory scheme, look at that loss, go down to the taxpayer level, look at their individual income tax return, see if there's a corresponding loss on that return, and if there is, he can calculate a tax on that very easily, and he can calculate a penalty on that very easily, multiply it by 20%. And under the current scheme, he can summarily assess that and collect it. If the taxpayer doesn't like that, and basically the only arguments the taxpayer have at that point are individual defenses to the penalty, reasonable cause and good faith. I cannot see how the individual can get out of the penalty at that point when there is a conclusive determination that their partnership was negligent when their partnership took this loss. So I think they're stuck with the merits of the penalty. They can only defend on reasonable cause and good faith. The only way they can defend on reasonable cause and good faith is they have to pay and bring a refund suit within 6 months of the time they're notified of this computational adjustment. Now, I think that's important, and that's one of the problems we have here. The traditional refund remedy available to a taxpayer is you have 2 years from the time you pay the tax or penalty to file a refund claim, and then thereafter you can file a refund suit if you haven't settled the thing with the IRS. The refund scheme under TEFRA is compressed severely. 6 months, you gotta pay it, and you get file a refund claim. That's a problem. I submit to the court that most, if not all, of these people aren't gonna be able to come up with the money in 6 months. So they're gonna be stuck with this assessment. And that's the problem we have with these outside basis cases.
Now, what about the counsel told us about the commissioner's recent policy determination that the taxpayer could instead bring a due process?
Well, proceeding. Yes. I don't know what the commissioner has in mind with that, but my understanding is that's always been the case. If you are assessed a tax, individual taxpayers assessed a tax, you have available to you the collection due process procedure. And if you had not previously had the ability to contest the merits of that particular tax, you can bring a collection due process to block collection in part. The problem with collection due process is it doesn't stop collection entirely like a deficiency notice does.
Well, when you bring this collection due process proceeding or open it and stops payment in part.
It stops payment.
Okay. When you do that, can you reopen the question that was raised resolved at the partnership level?
Absolutely not.
So it's in that respect, it's the same as your individual refund action.
Similar, but for the fact that and this is important, in the collection due process, they can still take certain collection actions. The most important thing they can do to hurt the taxpayer is they can file a notice of federal tax lien, which completely messes up your credit if you're a business person out there. So the collection due process certainly is a possible avenue of a remedy for a taxpayer who doesn't like what happened at the TEFRA level, but it is nothing compared to the affected item statutory notice procedure. And
the deficiency procedure.
Correct. That data.
Is the deficiency procedure, you don't have to pay.
Correct.
Right, and that's the key, right? That's,
absolutely.
That's what this is all about, is that best I can unpeel the onion.
Yes, that's no question about it. In answer to Judge Kavanaugh's question, what's the underlying policy consideration? They've never spelled it out, but I've been doing this for a long time, and I think the policy consideration is very simple. And the reason the IRS is digging their heels in on this case, and we're back again before this court on a matter that should just be handled with an affected item stat notice and forget it, is the commissioner is bound and determined to crack down on these son-of-boss taxpayers. He does not like them. He thinks they're very bad people, and he's not going to give them a thing. And that's why we're here.
But in the deficiency, suppose it goes to deficiency procedures, won't the commissioner crack down on them in the deficiency procedures?
I'm sure he will.
But I guess the point is, if they don't have to go to deficiency procedures, some people won't be able to pay in advance and thus will never get their individual legal claims.
They do have a defense. And the way it'll play out in the deficiency procedures is the individual taxpayers under 6664, I think, have a reasonable cause and good faith.
Right. Defense. I'm saying if the deficiency applies, I get that. But they don't want the deficiency procedure to apply.
The commissioner doesn't.
Correct.
Right? Absolutely.
Right. And then how would it play out?
Okay.
Those two defenses you just mentioned, if I may, are you saying those are we referring to those in the due process context or in the deficiency context?
Either one.
I see. Okay. Thank you.
Here's the way it plays out.
Under the commissioner's view.
If the commissioner is successful in this case with this argument, here's how it plays out. Unlike a normal partnership case, such as the one that recently was quoted by the government, the First Fidelity or Fidelity International, where you have on the partnership return losses that are negligently put on that return, where the IRS could say, okay, that loss is no good, right down to the 1040 individual income tax return, boom, tax, boom, assessment, they're done. We don't have that here. These outside basis cases do not present a penalty base where you can calculate a penalty. And it's quite clear when you look at the FPA, the Notice of Final Partnership Administrative Adjustment, tax court laid it out. There's nothing there to get your
but how would it, you get to how it would play out under the commissioner's view and why that's a problem for you.
Well, the problem for me is without any information on what the penalty base is at the partnership level, if the IRS has the power to summarily assess a penalty at the partner individual level, what do you think they're going to do? They're going to make up a number and assess it.
And then what happens?
Then the taxpayer is shafted half the time, because half the time they're going to be wrong in favor of the government.
Shafted because they can't get into court.
Correct.
They don't have the money to pay it to get into court.
Correct.
Now tell me why the outside basis is one in which at the partnership level there is this rough estimate rather than any accurate calculation.
Yes.
Tell me why.
Because the outside basis cannot be determined by looking at the partnership. If you want to see how you calculate outside basis, it's code section.
The outside basis is simply the value of the asset being brought into the partnership?
In part.
In part.
In part. It 705 tells you how to calculate it. And it is a mess. It's very complicated. Take a look at 705. It's got like 10 different sections. Each one sends you to another code section, and by the time you get through with the factors, you got a dozen or two of them in there to figure out how to calculate outside basis. It is very, very complicated. And I submit to the court that if the IRS has the ability to summarily assess a penalty based on outside basis, they're just going to gin up a number and assess it.
And assess it. Let me just make sure I understand. They're going to summarily assess it, and then you have 6 months?
6 months.
Okay, and if you can't come up with the money in the 6 months,
you're done.
You're done. Right. Whereas under your approach, they can't summarily assess it because you get the you get to do the deficiency procedure. And therefore, you get your day in court, so to speak, before you have to pay it.
Correct.
Yeah.
And
okay.
And that's what we're talking about here.
Right.
And the policy determination made at the commissioner's level is he's not giving these son of boss guys a thing if he can help it.
Now, what about the multiple paper, multiple proceeding concern that was raised?
Well, sure, it's going to be longer with the affected item statutory notice of deficiency, but one thing I'm glad Ms. Oppenheimer cleared up a problem with that I had. In her brief, she says that these amendments for 1997 require the penalty determination to be made at the partnership level. They don't. And the pre-1997 scheme is still in place. The 1997 amendments gave the commissioner additional powers to determine penalties and summarily assess, but it didn't take away what he had pre-1997, which was affected items, statutory notices of deficiency for penalties. So I just want to make sure nobody got hung up on that.
What about his discretion? That's your point.
Yeah.
All right.
Sure.
Now, what about the question that Judge Kavanaugh asked, which I was pursuing earlier with your opponent there, which is the fact that at the partner level, you could end up with five different jurisdictions and therefore five different ultimate circuit court opinions concerning what the value of the outside basis was?
The answer to that is right now the national rule is the tax court's rule. And that rule, as far as I'm concerned, is obviously correct. I assume this court's going to go along with that. Any other court's going to go along with it. It's a no-brainer. In the unlikely event that some other court, appellate court out there, decides, no, the tax court's wrong, no, the D.C. Circuit's wrong, I'm going to go off on my own, I don't think that's going to happen, not in a case like this. I think that's nothing to worry about. And your question, Judge, on the discretion, yeah, he has discretion, but not in this case. Because in this case, he's required by the tax court's ruling to issue an affected item statutory notice of deficiency. Why? Because you can't figure out what the penalty is at the partnership level.
We understand that.
Mr. Robbins, would this scheme, statutory scheme, apply equally to, or the same way to, a partnership with a general and with limited partners?
It wouldn't make any difference whether they're general or limited.
So
that's the question.
Let me get to the next point. If the partnership is held to have been negligent and subject to penalty because negligent, in my experience anyway, it could only be the general partner that was responsible for the negligence. The limited partners would have had no role in the negligent conduct, ordinarily. So presumably they would have a defense against the penalty that the general would not have. Is that possible?
That's in the situation you're positing, yes. I think that normally they would. In these cases, and in a lot of the so-called limited partnership, limited liability companies, the players are the limited liability partners. And so I think they'd be stuck. But if you had some massive 100-partner limited partnership with somebody out in Bakersfield who didn't have a clue what was going on at the partnership level, sure, he might have a separate defense above and beyond his reasonable cause and good faith. He could say, I wasn't negligent.
That wouldn't be for, he wouldn't be foreclosed from presenting that defense under the government's view. He would just have to have paid first.
Yeah, I don't think
or he brought would be, a correct. Or brought a due process matter.
I think that's right. Yeah, okay. He wouldn't be foreclosed from that. And how successful he could be if he were a general partner, I think he wouldn't be successful at all.
Sure.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Rogers.
2 minutes for rebuttal.
I would first of all like to correct an inadvertent misstatement that I made in my opening argument. The CDP proceeding that the commissioner is going to allow, the only thing that the partners will be able to raise in a CDP proceeding if they bring one is they can raise any partner level defenses, such as the defense under 6664 that they had a reasonable cause and good faith for the tax underpayment. In this CDP proceeding, they would not be able to challenge the existence or the amount of the underlying tax liability. Thus,
so it's not as good as the deficiency proceeding.
Well, no. The advantage for us is that payment, you know, the payment of the penalty would occur earlier than the deficiency proceeding unless the taxpayer has individual defenses that he chooses to bring in a CDP proceeding.
I have two quick questions. One, if the other courts were to agree with the tax court's resolution, if we agree with the tax court and other courts around the mm-hmm. country do as well, then is there going to be any problem for the IRS in getting the money that it thinks due, other than the fact of having to go through multiple proceedings?
In other words, if every court comes to the same proceeding?
Same conclusions.
Same conclusions the tax court did.
Well, we certainly would not have a statute of limitations problem, but, I mean, that's something this court can't know at this point.
Understood, but that's why I asked it as an if, but... I'm just trying to figure out if that were to be the case, there would be no statute of limitations problem anywhere. It would just be a hassle to go do it in multiple places.
Right. And the payment would be the time. There's still the timing issue that the IRS would receive
right.
money later.
Although that brings up the point, which is the IRS seems to want to jam these people into not having an opportunity to come into court because they're not going to be able to pay first.
Well, this is done by statute. It's not something that the IRS does.
I'm just saying, by seeking to get out from under the tax court rule, the seeming motivation, tell me if I'm wrong, the seeming motivation is to jam certain people who won't be able to pay the amount in 6 months.
I have never heard anyone say such a thing.
I'm sure.
Is taxpayers' counsel speculation. I'm only addressing the practical consequences of the decision. I actually have never heard anyone at the IRS, you know, say exactly why they're pressing this, but I have always understood, you know, it's the multiplicity of proceedings and the possibility of inconsistent results.
Some things don't need to be articulated.
Yeah.
Best left unsaid. Now, the second thing is our court, as you're quite right, in the last case, were focused on the sham and the outside basis issue. But then we did go on to discuss this issue, and the tax court parsed the language of the opinion, I think, correctly. How do you get around the fact? I understand you can file an in-bank petition to get around our precedent, but how do we get around what we said in the prior case?
Excuse me, did you say you filed an en banc petition in the last case?
They did not, right?
Yes, that is correct.
Right. You didn't file a petition for panel rehearing either.
Yes, that's what I was curious about. You didn't even file a petition for panel rehearing. If you had these concerns about it, why did you not do so?
Well, because it really wasn't a final decision. It was remanded to the tax court, and we could not predict what kind of determination the tax court would make.
But it focused, the tax court's decision focused, as you had to assume it would, on the precise language in this penalties paragraph, which you characterized, I think in your brief, I'm paraphrasing now, as loose language not connected to the central issue in the case. You could have filed a petition for rehearing to prevent all this from happening if you thought it was a mistake?
I think at the time this happened, I don't think that we seriously considered filing a petition for rehearing. I don't think it was discussed.
My point is, I think the language does, as the tax court concluded, speak to the issue, and I'm not sure how we can get around it.
Well, of course, this court, in its prior opinion, never used the language, you know, never distinguished between numerical and non-numerical adjustments. It's never said direct or indirect. This court, in its prior opinion, never said that the adjustment to the partner, that the penalty has to directly result from the partnership item without...
That language could have been computed without partner-level proceedings. That was key language.
Well, in every single penalty proceeding, including... Well, let me go back and say, every single penalty, no penalty can be computed without partner-level computation.
I understand from your brief, and essentially you were saying that the last paragraph of our opinion was nonsensical.
Well, I wouldn't use it.
What you were saying in the brief.
I'm
putting it bluntly, but that's really what you were saying, in which case I do not understand why you didn't file a petition for rehearing.
Well,
but the point is, it's a little late now to raise that argument.
Well, as I say, the law of the case is discretionary doctrine, and we would hope this court would exercise its discretion to reverse the tax court's determination in this case.
I don't know if we, as a panel, can do that. Obviously, you can file in bank and do it, but speaking only for myself, I'm not sure you can surmount that language. And this language in this paragraph turns out then to be the key on which the tax court divides.
Right.
And they thought it was binding, and I think correctly so, again, speaking to...
You said it was dicta, but what you really say in the brief is it doesn't make any sense.
Right.
And it was also dicta. I think both things are true.
No, it wasn't dicta because it directed how the tax court was to go about determining which penalties could be determined in which kinds of proceedings. That's not dicta. That was setting forth the rule for the remand proceedings in the tax court. And then the tax court appropriately tried to follow in that language, and the majority concluded that it went against you. I don't think that's dicta.
There's a broad statement followed by the words "we agree," suggesting that what we're saying is not conclusively, but certainly suggesting that we thought it was the holding. The panel thought it was the holding. And the thing about which we said we agree was that since the tax court lacked jurisdiction to determine outside basis, we all agree on that, right?
Mm-hmm.
It also lacks jurisdiction to determine that penalties apply, i.e. are applicable, with respect to outside basis, because those penalties do not relate to an adjustment to a partnership item. And we kind of stuck with that. Penalties do not apply.
Well, it's our position, yes, outside basis is not a partnership item, but the shamming of the partnership is a partnership item, and so are contributions to the partnership. And it's our position that the penalties relate to those partnership items, and that once you disallow those partnership items, as the commissioner did in his FPA, that is the first domino to fall in a chain of falling dominoes, and then the consequence of shamming the partnership is that the taxpayer can have no outside basis in the partnership, and therefore he can't use his outside basis as the basis of the stock he sold. So, yes, basically it's our position that this court does have jurisdiction to determine the applicability of the penalties. In this case,
because of the sham. The next paragraph
nature.
Is where you run into problems on that from our prior decision. But anyway, we'll have to sort it out, I suppose.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you.